On the Record with Gavin Riley on News Talk.
Now, next weekend, as we all know, marks the 20th anniversary of the September 11 terrorist attacks, events which transformed our world. It's a day of many human stories of heartbreak and of heroism. And if you go to Kesharagan in County Leitrim, you'll see a remarkable memorial which commemorates one of the more remarkable lives that was lost that day. Father Michael Judge made his name in New York City during the AIDS epidemic. He became a true friend of a very shunned community. He later became the chaplain to the fire department of New York City. And officially speaking, although in chronological order he was not the first person to die that day, he is officially registered as the first victim of the September 11 attacks in New York. And the image of his remains being removed from the basement of the towers, which you can even see, I think, in some of today's papers, it's in today's Sunday Independent, at least, I believe, anyway, is one of the defining images of the event. Donald Fallon is here to tell us more about him. Donald, good afternoon to you. Leitrim's memorial is among the most unique in the world, but there are several remarkable 9/11 memorials in sometimes surprising places.
Yeah, this was a truly global event. You know, that what happened in Manhattan, Washington, and Pennsylvania, it affected people from right across the globe. And the victims of 9/11 are honoured in beautiful and kind of unique ways. The one that really moved me when I saw it in person in New York City, a battered piece of public art, the Sphere, stands now in Liberty Park. It had been in the plaza between the Twin Towers, and they've made no attempt to restore it. You know, it bears the scars of that day. In Italy and in London, there are monuments that incorporate steel beams from the falling towers, and they're really powerful in their simplicity. You know, when you look at this single steel beam, it makes you think about those structures and their scale and the magnitude of what came crashing down that day. But then there are many memorials that the general public will never see. You know, when you go to New York City in fire stations, or names on the sides of fire engines, which is a very quiet act of commemoration that kind of carries huge symbolism. And then in Leitrim, in lovely Leitrim, there's a bench and a park which honours a really remarkable member of the Irish diaspora. One of New York's most kind of enduring and beloved characters, even today. Honoured with a street name in New York City, remembered in the very community from which his parents came, Michael Judge.
And Michael Judge, it's one of those names where perhaps if you were to hear it said out loud, it might not sound very striking. If you were to see it written down, it's a little bit more striking, because Michael is spelt M-Y-C-H-A-L. And indeed, there's a fair chance that if you've been in New York in the last 20 years, if you were going down to do some shopping in Century 21, for example, down in that part of town, you might have come across the street that does bear his name. But it's not the name that he began life with. He was given another name in honour of an Irish patriot.
Yeah, Father Michael F. Judge, the F coming from that most Leitrim of names, which I carry myself, Fallon, was born Robert Emmett Judge.
Is that a Leitrim name?
Yeah.
There's
a picture of lovely Ross Inver in the family living room.
All right.
At home, but it is a Leitrim.
And there's you
name.
Standing on Hill 16 trying to pretend that you're truer than blue, and you present a podcast called Three Castles Burning.
On my mother's side, I think they go back to the time of the Vikings in Dublin.
That's the Dublin side,
we'll call it that. But yeah, I mean, you can tell a lot about the political environment in which Michael Judge was raised, because he was born Robert Emmett Judge, which is an incredible name, isn't it? And his dad, Michael Judge Sr., came from Kesharagan, as we said, his mother Mary Fallon from Drumcareen. But he was born amidst the Great Depression, himself in the Brooklyn of the 1930s. I mean, an enormous economic collapse, unlike anything, even what we lived through, severe enough to have actually brought back many immigrants. So there were people like Jimmy Gralton going back to Leitrim from the United States, and the Judge family decided, no, we're going to stick it out. And the American dream for this kind of Leitrim family becomes something of a nightmare. His father dies when he's a child. The family are trapped in very real poverty. This young lad works as a shoeshine boy on the streets. Mm-hmm. And this is all kind of personality-defining stuff, you know, later on. A friend recalling to his biographer, Michael Ford, that the poorer you are, or the more impoverished you are, the more he loved you. He'd lived poverty as a child and understood its shortcomings, he emphasised, with the shame of poverty. So it's a great contradiction of the Big Apple, and it always has been, you know, a city that embodies great lavishness, wealth, you know, the romance of New York, New York, if I can make it there, I'll make it anywhere, but which is also home to tremendous poverty. Not least of all in its boroughs. And that poverty was a part of Judge's life.
He finds religion in the aftermath of this great personal loss, you know, the loss of his father, and then all the trouble that brings through. And he's only a teenager then when he becomes actively involved with the Franciscans.
Yeah, and when he joins the Franciscan order as a teenager, 15 years of age, he goes on to become a priest ordained in 61 and becomes Father Michael. As you pointed out, the spelling is different, M-Y-C-H-A-L. And he joked that the name was to differentiate him from all the other Irish-American Father Michaels in New York City, of which, right, yeah. of which there were many. There was probably a Father Michael on every street corner. But it would be the 1980s he's appointed to the St. Francis of Assisi Church. That church, if anyone knows it, it kind of faces onto New York's 31st Street. So he comes into contact with an organization that will transform his life. Across the street, Engine One, Ladder 24 off the FDNY. And the thing about the FDNY is it has a deep Catholic migrant history, not just Irish, but also Italian. Mm. And this brings him into kind of direct, frequent contact with that station. And eventually he's appointed chaplain to the fire department in New York City in 1992.
And the early 90s is an interesting time then, because it's a time when New York City is gripped by this unfolding crisis and all this panic and a lot of, you know, to some sense, what we now know to be hysteria about the AIDS epidemic.
Yeah, and Judge becomes a kind of well-known face to those living with AIDS in the city of New York. The AIDS crisis, acquired immune deficiency syndrome, AIDS, takes off in the press in a big way as a story in the late 80s, early 90s. In San Francisco, in New York City, there seems to be, you know, gay men coming down what they consider some kind of mysterious cancer at the time. And it's very little understood when it makes its presence felt in New York. But there's a wave of activism that comes around it. And the slogan that's actually used by the activists, living with AIDS, dying from our mayor, the mayor was Rudy Giuliani. Giuliani, wow. who becomes one of the heroes of 9/11 in his own way, is cutting kind of vital services for those living with AIDS. So it's a time of really considerable fear internationally in this new illness, this mysterious cancer afflicting gay men, which of course they later figure out is something else entirely. And Judge very consciously, you know, he administers over the funerals of AIDS victims. He becomes actively involved in the issue with New York City activists. He provides religious services to those who have the illness and who often felt shunned by the church in the city. And there's a great story of one man dying in his arms who asks him, "Do you think God hates me?" And it then kind of becomes his mission, he says, to administer to such people and to bring these people in from the margins of New York City.
Knowing that AIDS was, you know, as you say, at the time, it was thought to be a cancer that somehow afflicted only the gay. A lot of people might wonder, well, then, well, what was a priest doing, you know, becoming such an ally for the cause? But Judge's own sexuality, in fact, was greatly influential at the time.
Judge was himself gay, now celibate, of course, within the church, but he's gay and he struggles with this sense of being a gay man, but he comes to accept it. His friend Brendan Fay, who's a well-known LGBT activist in New York and an Irish immigrant, he tells his biographer that never did I hear him speak about being gay as being a burden or a cross. He would say, "It's wonderful. Look at who we are as gay people at this moment in history, a gift for the church to witness change and be agents for change, both in church and society." But look, whatever about that optimism that Judge had, things are moving very, very slowly in American Catholicism and in Irish America. The St. Patrick's Day parade, as we've spoken about before on the slot, was, you know, explicitly off limits to gay people. So, you know, he would march instead in the alternative New York parade, never surrendering the day. The parade he marched in, still going strong, St. Pat's for All, was a really important thing, which kind of played no small role in changing the rules around the larger parade. But yeah, he was very public about the fact that he was a gay man. And I think that is a big part of the story of Judge.
Why do I have this suspicion that you've just managed to include the word St. Pat's for All just as some sort of Inchicore dare, that this is just your way of trying to spread the Pat's Athletic gospel?
They sometimes say St. Patty's Day, but St. Pat's is okay. Well,
we can make do with that, but if it's St. Patty's for none, thanks very much. Michael Judge returns home, a home is sort of in inverted commas, maybe with air quotes, as late as the year 2000, only a year before he died, and he visited the family homestead.
Yeah, and his Irishness is a very living thing. You know, he maintains contact with home. There's a really nice story about coming in 2000, the turn of the millennium. He arrives at a farmhouse in Leitrim and he asks for directions to his father's ancestral home. And a local farmer after 9/11 is recounting this story, and he talks about this priest from New York City taking away a pebble as a keepsake, and that if you won the sweep or the lotto, you wouldn't be as happy as he was that day. And it's something just very, very sweet, you know, in that anecdote, given what we know was just around the corner.
Anyone who has been to New York in the last couple of years and who's visited some of the official memorials and the official Ground Zero Museum, they might know a little bit about the story. But for those who don't, tell us about the morning of 9/11 and what Michael Judge does, because he is among the many other heroes of the FDNY and that he directly goes into harm's way that day.
Yeah, on the morning of 9/11, Judge kind of rushes to the Trade Center, and we see him in the surviving footage of that day in the white helmet of the FDNY chaplain in the lobby of the North Tower. And the footage that we have of Judge is amazing. It's one of the most incredible documentaries ever made. And it's kind of an accidental piece of brilliant archive. Documentary footage shot by two young French cameramen who'd gone to make a doc on the New York Fire Department. And they really weren't getting a whole lot of interesting stuff, you know. And they'd kind of run out of anecdotal footage of guys joking in fire stations or, you know, all the old stereotypical stuff. They couldn't really fill an hour and a half of this documentary. Mm-hmm. But they find themselves in New York City on the morning of this attack. And actually, they are the ones who shoot the only footage I know of the first plane going in. Absolutely incredible stuff. They're in the midst of the madness. It's really harrowing. But they are there with Michael Judge in the North Tower. And when the South Tower comes down, it sends debris kind of flying into the lobby of the North Tower, and Judge is killed. He just administered the last rites to someone before that. And it's a really perilous position to be in, you know, but he felt the need to be there. And one veteran fireman remembered, you could see it in his face. Judge was always joking around, usually. He'd always be saying hello to somebody, but at that time he was just stone-faced.
As we mentioned in the intro, the image of his body being removed from the scene ends up becoming, perhaps short of the image of the planes impacting themselves, it becomes one of the most widely reproduced images in the days to follow.
I think it's one of the most emotive pictures of that day and of human history. To me, it's only matched by the falling man, that incredible image from the South Tower. But Judge, they bring him to the altar of the nearby St. Peter's Church, and he becomes officially victim 0001 of the day because he's the first death documented. So you made that point at the beginning. He's not the first person to die in the day, but he's the first death that's officially documented. And there's a lot going on in that image, I think. You know, it almost looks like a painting. You've two firefighters, a veteran and a rookie. There's a guy, John McGuire, who's just a young guy who works in finance. But, you know, rather than running away, he felt he had to do something. And he rushes towards the towers as well while most people are running away from them. So it's a great moment of human decency and human solidarity on a day that the world seemed to be coming to an end.
And of course, the clouds of dust and debris all across that shot as well, which are one of the more unfortunately commonplace features of the photographs of that day. Judge's funeral then becomes this kind of symbolic thing in its own right, because it brings together different sections of New York life. And of course, it's happening only days after the attacks themselves.
It's televised, which is a big deal. And the footage from that day, it shows kind of men and women who'd spent days working at Ground Zero. They look absolutely wrecked. On the bucket lines, the city's poor, the kind of LGBT community, they're all there. And it's September 15th, so it's 4 days after the event. But by then, I mean, the world was just sick of watching, you know, repeated footage of planes smashing into buildings. So people really do stop and pay attention to this. And Judge's funeral, it's the first sense of the human impact, if you will, of the day. The other thing that strikes me looking back on the archive, I watched a bit of archive this week before this slot, was these really tragic interviews of people on street corners on September 12th to 13th, holding pictures of their husbands, their sons, their wives.
God, you forget. Actually, it's terrible to think 20 years ago that you could forget how much of a feature that was. But like, every street corner was just pictures of people that they hadn't seen and not knowing where they were.
And
we didn't have a sophisticated infrastructure set up for it. They were just standing there going, have you seen this person?
It's a reminder how much the world has changed in a very short period of time. But Judge's funeral, Father Michael Duffy, who presided over it, he told the congregation, we'll bury Michael Judge's body, but not his spirit. We'll bury his mind, but not his dreams. Bury his voice, but not his message. We'll bury his hands, but not his good work. We'll bury his heart, but not his love. Never his love. It's a very moving thing for a broad section of New York City. You have the mayor, Rudy Giuliani, in tears, and you have gay activists who'd gone to war with Rudy Giuliani, you know, sharing in this moment of great loss.
Even now, 2 decades on, and it might be striking, maybe it's gone under the radar for a lot of people, but 9/11 is still actually claiming the lives of some of the men that Judge worked alongside.
Yeah, 9/11 has proven to be a never-ending tragedy in all kinds of ways. And look, we're seeing that too in Afghanistan. I mean, the Taliban are back in power on the 20th anniversary of 9/11. How extraordinary is that? Judge is officially one of the 343, and that number is everywhere in New York City. Fire station plaques, the Ground Zero Museum. It's a number of FDNY men who lost their lives that day. But last year, on the 19th anniversary of the attacks, it was estimated that 227 FDNY firefighters have died since the event as a direct result of working at the Ground Zero site. That figure has gone up since. New Yorkers call it 9/11 cancer. I mean, it's a well-known thing in the city. So, you know, that's a battle that's still being fought for those men and women and their families in terms of providing them with the best support and medical care. And look, that would be a fitting memorial in its own way going forwards.
Indeed it would, and I suppose that much like the consequences of the event itself, that's a campaign and something for which we're going to be feeling the effects for a long, long time. Donald Fallon, as ever, thank you very much for that. Donald Fallon is the author of Henrietta Street from Tenement to Suburbia, and he's the presenter of the Three Castles Burning podcast on Dublin history.
On the Record with Gavin Riley
on News Talk